Today is Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Eileen Mulady Meekum, last name spelled Mulady hyphen Mecham. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
Hi, Tom. I'm great. Thank you for asking.
Great. Nancy, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. We ended part one where you had been offered a good government job working for the Department of the Navy in some sort of thrilling something, I'm sure, in a job that put you in a basement with no window.
And, environmental impact specialist.
Yeah, I have EIS written down. I'm thinking, what does that mean? Oh, yeah, environmental impact specialist.
I sit at a desktop computer and read reports and make analyses.
And make the big bucks.
Field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1977.
It was a permanent job with benefits.
Oh.
You know, it's not a lot of money, but it was the beginning of the ladder that you could climb up. But I'm an outdoors gal. I'm a nature gal. I'm not a sit-behind-a-desk gal.
And you gave that good job up for a GS-3 firefighting position?
Yeah, I came home on that same day to my mom's house, and she said the U.S. Forest Service called from the Sierra National Forest. They have an opening for a GS-3 firefighter, which is just about the lowest of the low, in the Kings River District. And I said, oh, that's what I want to do.
Had you been to the Kings River area before?
I had been in the area, yeah. I hadn't been where this station was going to be.
Okay.
But it's on the way to up Highway 168 to Shaver Lake. My station ended up being out of Dinky Creek, which I love that name, and the training facilities were out of a place called Trimmer. But it was just the north, or it's in the out of Fresno area, north of Sequoia National Park, which is where my family went a lot for camping growing up.
Okay. And this is the summer of 1977, is that?
It is, uh-huh.
Okay.
1977.
And how much firefighting experience had you had by then?
Oh, no, I was a college graduate. I had zero. This was...
Okay.
The jobs that I had before this consisted of the ones that I'd already outlined while at university. And then as a kid, I babysat, worked at a Taco Bell, worked at, I think... May Company one Easter, you know, and then I worked at that semiconductor factory I had already outlined.
Right.
So really nothing to that, but my dream and all of this was to get out into nature.
Mm.
And this was one way to do it. I was physically fit. I considered myself a tomboy and that I enjoyed doing all kinds of athletic things and things that challenged the mind and the body.
And so when you showed up there, how many other females were on your crew?
No, I was the only one.
Only one. Okay.
I was the very first woman on the Kings River District. You show up and you go through training, and they later added another woman later that summer. And then the training is down at the foothills in a place called Trimmer, and it's book learning. You're in a classroom.
Oh, wow.
And then... and you learn the three triangles of the fire, you know, combustion is a part of oxygen, ignition, and fuel. And you understand weathers, you understand radios, you understand all kinds of things. And then you have training outdoors, and you are working on fire engines, you're working with hoses, you're working with different tools such as McLeods, Pulaskis, saws, things like that. And so that summer of 1977, I was assigned as on a PTO, a power takeoff engine crew, which consisted of one leader, Eddie McMurtry, Eddie Mac, we called him, and three guys. And then I showed up as the fourth on the crew. And three of the four guys were okay with me at first. They kind of were tentative because I think when I first showed up, the consensus was their work was going to get a lot harder because they had to do their work plus mine.
Okay.
And within a short time, they saw my enthusiasm, they saw my athleticism, they saw that I learned quickly, and I wanted to work as hard as any of them. And all of that worked out great. And
nice.
After a while, in fact, I ended up going to some pretty big fires, and they acted like my big brothers at that time. And big campaign fires, you know, you get in line, for instance, to go get meals, and you're the only woman, and there's all these guys around. And they would, you know, stand in line in front of me and behind me and wouldn't let any of the guys give me any guff. So they
cool.
became my brothers after a while. In fact, I still am friends with one of them all these decades later. He still works at Sequoia National Park. He later worked for the Forest Service to the National Park Service. So I should say this is the United States Forest Service, Department of Agriculture. You also had to do something called get a red card, which means you had to qualify to be physically fit and to do all kinds of stuff. So in between fires and before fires and after you're qualified, that was a summer that I learned so much. I learned how to take care of tools, how to maintain tools, how to cut down a tree, and when you use a saw, the person who uses a saw is called a sawyer, kind of like Tom Sawyer. That's the profession, like a cooper makes bear, a sawyer uses a saw. So I became a qualified sawyer. And I learned to be a timber cruiser because after fires, you want to reseed an area. That was the policy back then. So you'd find trees. And I learned to climb trees with spikes and a rope, and then I would rappel down and bring down cones and cut branches off trees and top them and, you know, work my way down as I cut down a tree. So it was just magnificent in terms of making my field skills really good.
Hmm. What's a PTO engine?
PTO, power takeoff.
Yep. So did it run a pump or the power takeoff?
Yeah, it ran a pump. We had a pump. And I'm trying to remember the name of the guy. He had a beard. His name is not coming to me. But it was his second or third season on there. And he was kind of a hippie type philosopher kind of guy. But he knew how to run that pump. And, you know, when we had to go to a fire, when you could get close to the fire, we would use water. But back then, we had mostly tools. And to put a fire out, you need to either take away the oxygen or take away the fuel. And by wetting it down, you help an awful lot by getting rid of the fuel and the oxygen by putting water on it. But if you have to walk miles into a place, say you were a smoke jumper, or like we were, when we would go in by ourselves as a coyote camp, which is an isolated camp, then you would just move the fuel away from the fire. And the rule of thumb is when you would put line around the fire, that you wanted the line to be like a sidewalk around it. And that sidewalk's width was determined by the length, the height of the flames that were near you.
Mm, okay.
So it had to be 1.5 times the height of the flames. So if the flames were 2 feet high, then your line around the fire was 3 feet high as far as fuels.
Okay.
And then often I walked at nighttime with a Fedco, which is the brand of the 5-gallon water pack on your back. The nickname for it back then was the piss pump.
Okay.
And so you'd walk around and you'd look for fires outside the line, which were called spot fires. And then we would spray them with our piss pump, Fedcos. The another thing that we did is we often backfired, so I had a container full of fuel with a long nozzle on it, and I would light the end of the nozzle, and I would walk along the line that had been created and set the forest on fire so it would burn toward the fire, and therefore the fire wouldn't come back to the black that had already been burned.
Right.
But we learned to use tents, you know, survival tents, and shelters?
Yeah, little fire shelters had been invented by then and were being distributed. Okay.
We wore them on our packs, on our packs and on our belts. And more to the point, though, we were taught little things like when you're walking along a hillside, you always carry your tool in the downhill hand, not the uphill hand, because if you drop it, it would roll down and knock your feet out from underneath you. So little things like that, you know.
Hmm.
And if you really are stuck, take a chance, run through the fire to the black.
Okay.
Run to where it was burned or find a water source. So
right.
I learned a lot that summer.
What was it like being on your first fire?
My first fire was not that spectacular. It was, interestingly enough, a fire that had been put out the previous fall.
Oh, wow.
And it had snowed on the fire, and it had smoldered under the fire the whole winter long.
Wow.
Which I come to find out that is not uncommon.
Okay.
And so in the heat of the summer, it went from smolder to flames again. So by the time we got to it, it was just a couple of acres.
Okay.
Yeah, and we did a lot of other things. For instance, we would put slash piles together, and we carried this 40-pound roll of tar paper up and down the hillsides, and we'd rip off a piece, and we'd put it on the pile because you didn't want to light them off until there was snow, but there had to be a dry spot.
Mm.
We also, one of the things I used to did, which I think got me in good with the guys, is there was a lot of cattle grazing in the Forest Service. And every now and then you'd get a call that a cow had been hit by a car or a truck or something, was laying in the middle of the roadway. And so they would assign us, because we had lots of busy work to do in between fires.
Ah.
And I remember going down there, and there's no way you could haul off a 2,000-pound cow. So it had to be gutted first. And being a biologist didn't bother me at all. I took out a knife, sliced it open, pulled out its intestines, made it, you know, 500 pounds lighter, and then we could easily haul it off. And they just thought that was very cool. None of them wanted to do it, that I didn't mind the stink and the pulling of all of that and taking care of that. We always wanted to take steaks, but our supervisor wouldn't let us.
No eating the roadkill.
That's right. That summer I also met a guy that I became very close to later on. He was a Menachi Indian descent.
Hmm.
And that winter I ended up living with his family at Fryant.
Oh, wow.
And learning a lot about the Menachi Indians.
Where did you live with them?
Fryant.
How do you spell Fryant. That?
Fryant.
And where's that?
It's there's Millerton Lake. I think it's a state park. It's there. Unfortunately, I mean, it was beautiful, primitive area in the foothills, in the mountains, below Shaver Lake and that area.
It's yours.
But they got a. I'm still in touch with the family that's left, and sadly, they got the casino contract. And the family that I lived with, it was on their land. They built the casino, so they got very rich very quickly, and it's sad to see how things have changed.
Okay. Okay. And so, at the end of the summer, this is a seasonal position. Is that right?
That's right. So after the end of the summer, I got a job working for a large animal veterinarian. He's got a great name, Dr. Bob Cutright. Isn't that a great name for veterinary surgery?
Cutright, yeah.
Cutright. I was in Fresno. And he was lousy at sending out his bills. And he needed somebody to do that. And I'm a certified veterinary assistant. So I got put in there and I organized all of the medications and stuff. Because he, being a large animal vet, had a truck. And all the medications were on the trucks. And he had water tanks to fill. And he would go out on all these calls. Calls didn't come to him. He went to the calls. Horses and cattle mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal was, if I got everything organized and sent out and started collecting money, then I could start going on the calls.
Oh, wow.
That was a real incentive.
Cool.
And so some of the calls were great. I mean, I learned how to castrate horses. You know, I'd hold the head. And some of these stories are in my first book, Park Ranger. We would go up to the foothills to people who'd lived there forever. And when you castrate a horse, that means you're taking their testicles off. And sometimes some of them are up into the body, and that's called cryptorchid, cryptorchid. And you had to get that down. And if you didn't, then the testosterone would still flow through the horse, and he would be an unruly stallion rather than a calmer gelding.
Hmm.
But in some of these places, after you emasculated the horse, you had to throw the testicles over the head of the horse. And then they wouldn't be proud. That was a sure guarantee that there was no testosterone left.
Wow.
And if you didn't do that, you didn't get called back because you didn't know the local folkways.
Huh.
Yeah, so kind of fun. There's one time we went to a farm, and there was a cow who had just calved, and she had a prolapsed uterus. So imagine a cow standing there with this sac coming out her uterus hanging down to almost the ground.
Wow.
So, you know, you'd spray that off, and you'd push it back in, and you'd sew up her vulva, and off you'd go. Mm-hmm. You know, because all of the, she couldn't calve again because all of the ligaments would have been torn by that point.
Yeah.
We went to a place called Golden Jeans out in Riverdale, and that was fascinating to me because we would take embryos. They would take embryos and from these million-dollar cattle, and they would implant them in rabbits and mail the rabbits back east, and then they'd put them in some, you know, $200 heifer and grow this $100,000 calf in there.
Wow.
So it was very, it was the very beginning of that kind of embryo transfer stuff.
Hmm.
What else? Oh, I remember we went to Tony Coelho's cut farm because I loved cut horses, and one time they were they were going to sell a stallion, and he was going to stand stud, meaning his job was to impregnate mares.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to prove that he had the sperm to do the job, you brought a mare over that was in heat. The stallion mounted her, and then you took something called an AV, an artificial vagina, which is a warm water-filled sac, and you placed that over his penis as he mounted her. He ejaculates into that. You take the cup at the end. You look at it under a microscope. You count the sperm, and that horse that day sold $125,000.
Wow.
And you know, this is back in the 70s, and so I just thought, I can't tell the difference between a $100 horse and a $125,000 horse, but that was the game back then. And so being a veterinary assistant was just fabulous.
Where were you staying at the time?
I had a little apartment in that was later on. I had a little apartment in Clovis, California, on Jefferson Street.
Okay. And then thinking about furthering your government career, did you apply for more seasonal jobs then?
Yeah, every winter the government put out a thing, and I think it was January back then. This is before the website USA Jobs. This is before the internet.
Okay.
So you got to apply to two different places.
Just two?
Two different places, but I wasn't thinking about the park services at all at this time.
Okay.
I had broken up with my boyfriend at the time, and I was kind of sad, and I worked for the large animal vet, and then I got called back to Catalina Island. I think I told you that I did work there as a senior, but I got called back to work as a marine biologist. So after I worked for the large animal vet, I went to Catalina Island. I worked as a marine biologist and wrote that paper with Bob Givens I told you about.
Yeah.
And would go back and dive with other people and had a really good time. And then I got a form saying, would you like to work for the Forest Service again? And I said, yes. So the next summer of 78, this time the job was as a backcountry ranger.
Okay, so hang on a second. I want to go through this job application process because it doesn't happen like that anymore. So
no, it was a form called an SF-171, as I recall.
FF as in Frank Frank?
Sam Frank, SF-171.
SF, Sam Frank, 171.
171. Would you, I still have my application copy.
Would you have to go to a Forest Service office somewhere to get the forms to fill out? How would you do that?
You would go to almost any government office anywhere in any city.
Okay.
The SF-171 was the standard form for, I believe, almost any low-level government job at the time. And
okay.
Then this is for the Forest Service, this is for the Park Service, this is for Bureau of Rec, this is for the Department of the Army. So that was the form you used, and then you put in, you would look at the flyer that you had, and you'd put in the codes, and then you'd mail them off, and then they would go. It was all done by mail.
So they would mail you a flyer saying, these are the jobs and these are the places that are coming up later this year?
No. In my particular case,
yep.
The U.S. Forest Service, because you have an evaluation at the end of your season.
Okay.
And if you get a trying to remember the name of the terminology exactly, but okay to rehire is basically what it says versus we don't want you back.
Okay. All right.
If you're the okay to rehire and you want to come back, you have you get first pick at a job over a new hire.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So the Forest Service at the Sierra National Forest said, we like what you did. You want to come back. We have an opening as a backcountry ranger.
Okay.
Out of Dinky Lakes and what they call the Woodchuck Wilderness, which is now the John Muir Wilderness. And I said, sure, that'd be great because I had all these skills now.
Right.
And so I got my went back, went through the training, got the red card, and worked. I can't remember his name, but I remember he had this VW bus that he had cut the back off of. So it was like just the cab and then the bed of it. It was really an interesting bus. So that's when I learned to pack mules and horses.
Okay.
So I learned to pack mules and horses so we could take stuff into the backcountry and supplies and stuff. I learned the diamond hitch and the box hitch. And then I was with a crew of, there was three of us at any one time, but sometimes the crew changed a little bit. Sometimes as many as four. There was one cabin that was sort of base camp, and then we would go out and do trail work. So we were, our main job was to build trails and, you know, water bars and build trails and to make those doggone blazes on trees.
Mm.
So I had an axe and a mallet, and I would make little rectangles and then long rectangles and on lodgepole pines and stuff. And at the time, I was very proud. I look back now and go, gosh, I'm sorry I hurt the trees. But then when I'm back, when I'm backpacking in a place that's not often used, I look for the blazes and go, thank goodness there's blazes.
Somebody help me figure out where to go.
That's right.
Yeah,
so I
guess
that's the summer I also walked the farthest in one day, 28 miles. And I did that because I came off of my days off and I walked into the cabin area, 14 miles, sat on the front porch, bit on a piece of popcorn, broke off the back of one of my teeth, and walked all the way back out to go to the dentist. So I think that's my record, 28 miles in one day.
Wow, well done.
Yeah. So that was with the Forest Service and that last. And you fought an occasional fire, but for the most part, I was built trails, packed mules, did a lot of saw work, and there's a one day I remember we were at a at a camp we had made because you can't just go back to your cabin every day. You have to make what we call coyote camps, you know, this little spot camp.
Mm-hmm.
And we put up a little hammock, and I was laying in the hammock. One guy was over at one side, and one guy was on the other side. And we were all just sitting there kind of chatting, and then there was a lull, you know, how that happens in the chatting. And I looked over, and walking into camp, not 15 feet from me, was the biggest mountain lion I'd ever seen.
Wow.
His face was as big as a dinner plate.
Wow.
And he was walking in, and we all saw it, and we just all froze. And then he lifted up his paw to take another step toward us, and then he just froze in midair. I can still see this vividly.
Wow.
He just stopped and held his paw in midair. Never moved his head, but his eyes moved. And then he slowly started walking backwards.
Wow.
And we never moved. We never yelled. We never
just
said anything.
Sat there looking.
That was my first wild mountain lion sighting. And he was right in the camp. It was amazing.
Wow. And a big adult, huh?
Yeah. And I have pictures of me, you know, cutting and with a Sawyer and doing stuff. Oh, but the other fun thing. And I did this the summer before, but not as much as this summer, is when I would often hike out 7 or 8 miles at the end of my day to get in my car, drive down to Sierra High School to play softball. So I played summer softball in a league. And then afterwards, I would get back in my car, drive up and hike in before dawn the next morning so that I could work the next week. So I played once a week on the softball thing.
Wow.
And if the games filled on my days off, then sometimes I played there. But I loved softball, and so it was worth it. And our team won the league that summer.
Oh, cool.
I was the MVP, and I've got the softball with it all signed.
Oh, wow. Fun.
That was fun. When you're young and you didn't need much sleep and you could go, it was pretty amazing time.
So this is 1978. This was in Sequoia National Forest?
Sierra National Forest.
Sierra National Forest.
Sierra.
Okay. What were you thinking for the fall winter coming up 1978,
I
1979?
wasn't sure at first, but that very summer, I went to Sequoia National Park on some of my days off, and I camped in a place called Dorst Campground in Sequoia National Park. And there was a guy, maybe 55, 60 years old, who was the ranger there. He had a little bit of a paunch, and his name was Dave Thompson. And I went on his walk, and he was a really good naturalist giver, really would talk. And partway through, I said, What are the epiphytes up on the tree? And he looked at me and he goes, well, those are staghorn lichen, and that's old man Beer. And that's, I said, oh, cool, thank you. And at the end of the walk, he said, just a minute, young lady. And I said, yeah. And he said, come on. He goes, nobody ever asks about the epiphytes in the tree. And I said, oh, well, I'm a biology graduated from UCLA and working for the Forest Service now. And he goes, would you like to be a park ranger? And I said, really? You think I could?
Whoa.
He goes, oh, yeah. So he invited me to his cabin, and we talked for a long time. And he said, here is a grant, or because in order to work as a permanent, you have to be a permanent. It's a really bad situation for the U.S. government at that time.
Wait, say that again. Explain that.
In order to work as a permanent for the government, you have to have worked as a permanent for the government. It was a real catch-22.
Yeah.
For instance, as a seasonal, let's say I worked 10 years as a seasonal for the Park Service at that time. It's changed. And somebody who worked for U.S. Army Corps of Engineer for 3 months, one day, whatever it is, as a permanent, they could apply for a park ranger position. I could apply, and they would get it because I did not have status.
Got it.
Status is the golden key that gets you a permanent job. So this was one way out of it, and that was having, they were just now starting to open up the doors to people who did not have status. So if you had like a master's degree, or if you had this, that, or the other thing. And he said, I'll write a letter of recommendation for me. I said, how can you do that? You've only met me a day. And he goes, I know. I said, oh, that's great. So he wrote a letter of recommendation for me for this one particular job as an intern naturalist at Sequoia National Park. I did not get it. But it put it in my mind that maybe that's what I wanted to do. So that winter, I applied for the National Park Service. And I applied, you can only apply to two places. One was Yosemite and one was Sequoia National Park. And I got offered a job in both places as a seasonal. And I said, and I had talked, and I went and talked to Dick Burns, who had called, or he called me, and he said, I have an opening here at Lodgepole for a naturalist. But he says, according to your SF-171, you're a Sawyer, you're a backcountry ranger, you've done trail work. He said, are you sure you wouldn't rather be in the protection division? I said, oh, no, I want to be a naturalist. I'm a biologist, and I want to do that. And he goes, well, okay. And he hired me as a GS-4. Woo-hoo, a step up, you know. And so that year was 1979 was the year I became a naturalist at Lodgepole and Sequoia National Park.
Okay,
And that was the
so
beginning.
hang on a second. Because I'm kind of going back to when you were first on the fire crew, you were the first female in. Another female came in
Right.
later in the summer.
Yeah.
For a 50-something-year-old park ranger to
He too,
he was
Dave
ahead
Thompson
of
was
his
also,
time.
he was, but he was not a permanent. He was the seasonal Dorst Ranger. He had been there for 15 years at that point. In the wintertime, he was a teacher at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in biology. Much more open-minded than a government employee.
Got it. I was just going to say, how was it that
Yeah.
Dave Thompson had the because I'm doing all these other interviews and it's like, oh, good luck with that.
Yeah.
We don't
No,
we you know.
he was a special, special person.
And
And I knew him up until he died. He's a
what
wonderful
about
guy.
Dick? Because he clearly.
Dick Burns was an interesting guy. He was permanent with the National Park Service. He had fought in World War II, and I didn't know the details until I met and married Kent about what he did during World War II. I said, he packed mules and did something, and he goes, oh, no. He was one of the elite people that went through the mountains in Burma or something and went over the Himalayas. I don't know what he did, but he was with an elite Marine Corps crew that did all kinds of stuff. So
wow.
He was really something. And then being a government, you know, he started work at Sequoia National Park, and he was trained, I think, by somebody who was a park ranger in the 30s. So it's kind of neat that I was trained by somebody, because he retired just a couple years after, 2 years after he hired me.
Oh, wow.
So he was older, 60s something or other. So he had been there for 30 something years, but he was so old school that when they did their first burn, I was told this story, when they did their first burn of Sequoia groves, which we now know is very important.
Yeah.
At the time, his whole career was protecting the big trees, that he cried.
Wow.
He was so old school that when he gave bird walks, in between talking about birds, he would recite from memory poetry.
But yet he was willing to hire females.
I don't know that. I don't know if he was told to do it, because the chief of interpretation was younger. His name was John Palmer, and he was a kick, man. He was great. He used to work. He got his status down at, what was the story he told me? At Big Bend National Park, right on the border.
Okay, yep.
With Mexico. And one time I had a conversation with him, and I said, so what did you do down there? And he said, and I can't remember the exact phrase, and I said, that means get in the back of the truck in Spanish. He goes, right, that's all I could say. So his job was to drive along the border, tell people to get in the back of the truck, and drive them back across the border.
Wow.
But, no, I actually went to graduate school with him.
Oh, wow.
So you wondered what I did in 70 after that backcountry years. I went back to school and got my master's degree.
Okay.
So 78, 79 to 80, those winters I was at Cal State University, Fresno, and Fresno State, and I got my master's degree in biology. The thesis was in paleontology.
Okay.
The fossils of Maricopa, which was later published.
Okay.
But I was, that first winter when I got my letter that saying I got accepted as a naturalist, and I said, oh boy, you know, because it was one thing for Dick Burns to say, I'm going to offer you a job, but when you got that letter, it was very special. I ran into the lab that I shared with another graduate student, and his name was Dick Palmer. And I said, Dick, I got the job at Sequoia. And he goes, oh, that's great. You'll be working for my dad. And I said, Dick Palmer, John Palmer. John Palmer, your dad is the chief naturalist there? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, well, why didn't you tell me? You could have pulled through the string. He goes, they would have figured it out that you were okay anyway. So
I just find it interesting, though, that Dick Burns was clearly, you know, wanted you to consider going into protection.
Absolutely, because of my background. I had no field. I had thought maybe I wanted to get my teaching certificate at one point.
Okay.
So when I was at UCLA, I went part-time to, God, I almost forgot about this. I went to Long Beach State and took some night classes to get my secondary teaching credential.
Okay.
And so I went and taught at a local high school a couple of times and stuff, and I thought, you know what? I don't want to be a disciplinarian.
Oh, interesting.
And that's what you did half the time.
Huh.
So I thought with a master's degree, I could teach other things. So I never did get my secondary teaching credential. But so I had limited public speaking experience because of that. And almost all my stuff was, I can use a saw, I can use a this, I can do this, do
right.
that. You know, but I did have a degree in biology. So.
Well, it's an interesting time for the Park Service because they were trying to get females into protection. And
back in the 70s, no.
Well, but there's Dick Burns. So somebody was telling him.
No. He was not trying to get me into protection.
Oh.
He was not trying not to pick me. Wouldn't you rather apply to protection? He had no pull in protection.
Oh, I see. He was trying to get you to apply someplace else, somewhere else.
Yes. So he could go past me to somebody else because you are.
Interesting.
He has to offer it to different people in a row. And as soon as I say no, he can go to the next person.
Thank you. I misunderstood that.
Yeah, no, he didn't want me.
Okay.
But later on, we became great friends. And up until he died, and after he retired, I'd go visit him at Three Rivers. And I ended up living in the cabin he and his wife Peggy lived in that they raised their girls in the summertime.
Oh, wow.
And so I would go down, and I actually did an oral history for Dick Burns.
Cool.
Before he passed away.
Nice.
And so that was a lot of fun.
Great.
So after he realized that I knew what I was doing, I had a good mind and a good memory, and one of the things I could do, and I think it's the Irish in me, is tell stories. Then I became, with his help and everybody else's, I think a top-notch naturalist.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so going to get your master's in 78, 79, 80, and working as a seasonal in the summer, is that how that worked? Okay.
Yeah, so I actually was a seasonal for 14 total summers.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I worked at Sequoia National Park in the summer, and then in the wintertime, I either worked at a winter national park, or I went back to school. Let me backtrack a little bit. There are national parks where their greater visitation is in the wintertime.
Right.
Everglades, Hawaii, Texas, Death Valley, things like that. Other parks, almost all the other parks, they get their greater visitation in the summertime. So I worked at Sequoia National Park all summers, and then I would work the winter. I worked Death Valley several winters. I worked Everglades a winter. I worked at the U.S. Arizona Memorial and Pearl Harbor for a winter, which now is called War in the Pacific. But my first summer in Death Valley, I had become an EMT while I was at graduate school, and I took other classes. And it was frustrating not to being able to do more. So after my first – was it my first season – yeah, my second season at Sequoia, after my first of Death Valley, I put myself through paramedic school at Stanford University, which does not have a paramedic school anymore. But the reason I picked it is it was accelerated. It was 6 months.
Oh, wow.
So I could still go back and be naturalist at Sequoia National Park.
Okay.
So my boss at the time was a man named Bill Tweed, and he would let me have particular days off in August when the class started, so I could drive to Palo Alto, live in my van, go to school, drive back, and be a naturalist. And the school allowed me to make up stuff, so that was good.
Cool.
And by the time I did my – I'm sorry.
I was thinking, did Bill see the need for this? Because the Park Service was struggling with this as well, going, you know what, we need our people to know more.
No, not at all.
Okay.
In fact, you will see in as the story progresses that it became not a problem, but it's the protection division, which we will talk about, which is what I did both protection and interpretation at the Grand Canyon.
Right.
But the protection division is emergency medical services, search and rescue, structural fire, wildland fire, resource management, and law enforcement. Within the protection division is where emergency medical services is. If they need a little bit of extra help, they would call anybody else who had the skills. So when I was at Death Valley in the wintertime, I was a naturalist. I was only one of two EMTs in the entire national monument at the time. It's now a national park.
Mm.
And so if they needed help, they often called me out after hours, and I would go to car crashes and different things and stuff like that. But that was not my job. I was a naturalist.
Nancy, when did this change happen from everybody helped everybody else to sort of a
specialization?
Specialization. Thank you very much. I was going to say kind of boxing things up, where you're just an interpretive ranger. You can't help us in protection with this search and rescue or with this accident,
right,
because you're just not in the right department.
That began after the riots in Yosemite Valley.
Okay.
I can't remember. 74,
Stoneman Lake riots.
And what happened there is they realized that the generalist rangers who were friendly and all that kind of stuff, it wasn't working out. They were supposed to be law enforcement, but the old school people wouldn't let them carry their guns. Kent was a park ranger protection at Death Valley before, when I first met him. And it was so old school when he first started there, he wasn't allowed by the superintendent to walk into the visitor center with his gun on.
Okay.
He had to leave it in his glove compartment.
Okay.
So they didn't want the Rangers to look like cops.
Okay.
They wanted to be friendly. You can go probably even to today and talk about what government employee is the most revered and the nicest. It would all come out park ranger. But now, today, you know, when you met me, I wore body armor.
Yeah.
I had an M16 rifle. I had a Sig Sauer, you know,
mm-hmm.
9mm or
right.
45 or whatever it is I had. And so, but that changed beginning with the Stoneman riots because they didn't have the skills. So people started to go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in the 70s to learn these skills, land management agencies. They later were combined with others. When I went to FLETC, it was Department of Defense, U.S. Forest Service, National Park Service, Tennessee Valley Authority, all these land management agencies that had law enforcement regulations. They needed somebody to enforce them. So began in the 70s, slowly began the division then. So, for instance, state parks, California state parks, the people up until about 2 years ago, the guys and gals that carry the guns also are supposed to give evening programs. They haven't made the hard separation, but they are starting to in a lot of places.
So
it started in the 70s.
If you were queen of the world and you had a magic wand, would you change things? And if so, how?
In terms of what?
Well, in terms of what became a specialization.
When I was at Grand Canyon, there was something they wanted to have called stovepiping.
Okay.
And the stovepipe goes straight up and down, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted somebody to, at the very top, to be able to tell the next person in line, to tell the next person in line, to tell the next person in line what to do. That was the chain of command. But what happened at Grand Canyon and every other park, that the superintendent, and then if there was a deputy superintendent, may have had no law enforcement background. Maybe they came up as somebody who worked in management, somebody who worked in maintenance, somebody worked in interpretation. This is before the senior executive service, and maybe they were SES. And maybe they had zero protection background.
Okay.
They were the superintendent, and ultimately they told the chief ranger what the policies and procedures would be. And if they decided that they didn't want, like they told Kent, not to walk in the visitor center with their gun on, they had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And here was a guy who had no idea that Charles Manson was caught in Death Valley.
Right.
That there are bad and evil people, that the world has changed.
Right.
And so so that was it. And it's interesting. And if I could fix it, I would have every single law enforcement ranger, protection ranger, because I hate calling them law enforcement,
because mm-hmm.
they have so many other duties.
Right.
I would make them all be naturalists for 2 years first.
Okay.
I'd make them get people skills. I'd make them know about the resource that they are in. And then they can go off and start doing investigations for the murders and rapes and arsons that I did at Grand Canyon.
Right.
But I thought of my job at Grand Canyon, we're skipping way ahead, as I thought of myself as Andy Taylor.
Okay.
I'd go to different places, and I'd walk in with a smile on my face. I felt good about knowing everybody everywhere.
Right.
I was a people person. I'd
right.
go in the Yalta Bar, and I'd go into other places. And so there were a lot of people, though, that wanted to be big cop faces in
right.
the window. They wanted to wear the mirrored this and... That has nothing to do with training, but everything to do with personality.
Okay.
Who they hired. So I'm going to jump way ahead and tell you one of the things that made me eventually leave the Grand Canyon was there was openings in the supervisory things. And I hear I'd been at Grand Canyon now for, I forget what it was, 9-10 years at this point. And I was an assistant shift supervisor.
Okay.
And many times an acting shift supervisor. And somebody left, and I was the acting shift supervisor for a long time. And a new guy came in, and he had come directly from the California Highway Patrol. He was not an EMT. He did not know structural fire. He did not know resources. He could barely spell Grand Canyon. And he applied for the permanent shift supervisor. I applied for the permanent shift supervisor. And another guy did. When the other guy who I'd worked with for 8 years saw that I had applied, he went, "Oh, you're the best person for the job. I'm going to pull my name out." I said, "Great." Because at this point, I was a paramedic flight nurse. I was a captain and engineer on the structural fire brigade. I had a master's degree in resources management. I was a medical unit leader on wildland fire. I was on the search and rescue, not only high angle rescue, river rescue, and short haul qualified. I was the highest in every single category you could be in protection. I did not get the job. The guy in who was the big cop,
right,
got the cop got it because they wanted, I was told that the guys would not pay attention to me. Remember, there weren't any other gals on my shift, very few at South Rim, and that they that I didn't have leadership skills and that they would not do what I asked them to do.
Whoa.
And I said to this particular person, I said, "Well, they have been for quite some time. One person withdrew his name, and I would like to know who said that they would not follow my orders because, you know, I don't order people around. I tell them what's needed to be done, and it gets done."
Right.
I mean, we had all this kind of stuff. The average call, and this was given to me by Barb Bretvan, who's the head dispatcher, every year that tallied all the calls. The average calls and reports that were made per ranger was 150. I averaged 400.
Hmm.
So that is when I said, I was giving 110. I was ready to give more.
Right.
But it was an old boys club.
Right.
It was, and I left on, and I don't mind talking about these circumstances when we get to that part of the conversation.
Yeah.
But the whole point is there was, and there probably still is, a we want the guys to be the cops, and that's the mentality we want here.
Right.
So that began in the 70s, and I have been discriminated against my entire life and career.
Yeah, no, when I think about this as a citizen, not an employee of the Park Service that was working with Park Service employees, you always just brought, you know, the sunshine on your shoulder. And I was just like, why is Nancy like this, and why are those guys over there like that? And looking at the fracturing, if you're talking about specializations, but really it appeared to be fracturing in the park. And I'm like, okay, in the next 100 years, how's the park gonna come back around to being people that have to deal with rapes and murders and you know, just this very difficult real life stuff, poaching and being shot at or killed, versus
I have been both.
Yep.
I mean, not killed, but I have been attacked and had a guy with 7 guns go after me and all this stuff. The point is.
But you also
they were going to eliminate them at the big parks. They were going to eliminate park ranger protection, and they started to do that when they brought in the paramedics.
Okay.
And they were going to have park police do all the protection. The park police who are in Washington, D.C., who are at the White House and the Capitol and the Mall.
Right.
There was a point in time, and I, being out of the business now for 10 years, I don't know what came of that, but they were going to replace protection rangers with park police. And then they were going to have an ambulance crew from, be the medics. And then there would be naturalists. And then there would be firefighters. So there was going to be a 5-point division of personnel. Not a generalist anymore, which really is, I'm so glad I was a park ranger in protection when I did, because I was lucky to have the brain that I had and the skills that I had, because I loved it when the phone rang or my radio went off. I had no clue what it was going to be, but I was ready.
Right.
I loved the variety and the diversity of it.
But you were also able to say, you know, that's an epiphyte up in that tree. And that's what the majority of the visitors to our national parks are looking for.
I was doing horse patrol one time, and I met up with Ronnie Gibson one time.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in the circle in front of the El Tovar Hotel, and I said, "Simon de El Tovar, you know, he was a conquistador, and he came here and this," and I was telling him all about it. And he looked at me, he goes, "I didn't know that."
Hmm. Yeah.
And he had been there, what, 15 years at that point?
Yeah, yeah.
So I really think that if you're going to keep the park rangers as they are, doing all these different jobs, that they really, you know, they have to be naturalists for at least a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but on the other hand, you don't want somebody, and I'm going to say this as a descriptor because you'll know what it means, a panty waste.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want somebody who's a naturalist who can't, who cannot transition to taking somebody down.
Right.
I did not like being a law enforcement ranger, but damn, I was good at it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I had to. I walked into a situation where I had a guy who was probably 100 pounds on me. He was drunk. I turned around. I made him turn around, and I was holding him while I was doing a pat down. I found a 10-inch nine in his boot. He knew I found the 10-inch nine in my boot. My backup wasn't there. And as soon as he reached down for it, I grabbed the bottom of his jeans and I pulled straight up in the air.
Mm.
And he fell flat on his face. I was able to wrestle him down and put him into handcuffs.
Right.
And secure that 10-inch knife away.
Right.
So you can't be a naturalist. You can't be a nice person sometimes. You have to be a capable person.
And I guess that's asking a lot of everybody.
It is. I think I was special in that I was able to switch things off and on. I don't know, switch is not the right word, but it's how I went into the job. I didn't go in as a big cop, which
right.
is what a lot of people do. They look at the job as a cop, and they don't want to be firefighters. They don't want to be EMS. And most of them don't want to be EMS. Some of them aren't, you know, so I remember flying with the chief SAR person, and he hated flying, but he had to do it to qualify, and he screamed when we took off together.
Mm.
This was, you know who I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, he was scared to death, but in order to do it, he had to do that.
Right.
So people wouldn't do that if they had a choice. If you give your typical male that was on South Rim Patrol a choice, when I was there, they would rather just do law enforcement, especially the night shift in the summertime.
So do you think there's a possibility ever, I mean, just looking ahead, going, you know what we could do is actually... work toward people's skills of interpretation, of protection, of EMS, of medical services, and understanding that, of fire and search and rescue, sort of the thinking back about the 1920s and 30s where the ranger did it all and might not have done, you know, as good as we can do today.
And tell me how many people came to the national parks then.
No, understood. I get that, but I guess my
55,000 people a day came to the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, and in 1956, the first million showed up, and so I understand that a lot of people are there and the needs are great, but I'm just trying to think of, you know, is it possible?
Here, it's a personality thing, Tom. Not a skill.
Okay.
And it's there. We had a guy. They said, we would like to hire this person. On South Rim, and I was asked this by the district ranger, the district ranger, Dave Brennan, and he says he's a paramedic, but he's got this and his background. I said, you know, we can teach anybody to start an IV,
mm-hmm.
but you can't teach somebody to get along with people.
Right.
Well, they hired this person anyway, and he ended up trying to kill himself later on, 2 years later.
Mm.
You know, Phil?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was him.
Okay.
And they hire people for their skills and not for their personalities. That's
right.
A huge thing. And let me tell you what the number one problem was. It was half of our calls, if not more than half of our calls, were amongst the concessions.
Sure.
We didn't call Victor Hall. We called it Victim Hall.
Yeah.
You know, guns, drugs, everything. Nobody vets the people that want to come and live in the middle of nowhere, have nothing else to do but to get drunk and to use drugs.
Right.
It used to be when I started as a seasonal that they would bring in kids from college, Christian group kids and stuff, who would get together every night, have sing-alongs, and have bonfires back
mm-hmm.
in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
That's not the case anymore.
Right.
The world has changed, and I'm not sure I have an answer.
Yeah. No,
we can't go backwards.
This is it is a personality thing. I think you've really nailed it, and that's difficult. It's easy to hire for skills, Oh, this person's done this training and that training and that training. Great, hire them. And it's much more difficult to hire a person with skills and a personality that can judge a situation and go, hey, this is a stand down situation. This is going to be great. Oh no, this is stand up. Oh, you know, I bet there's a knife in that boot. And roll with those punches, or the blessings of being able to, sit down and sing a song with some people because they're really having some really good harmony over there at that campsite over there in Mather Campground.
Right,
That's
and I have to tell you, I truly, there are some people like that, but they're not usually in the hardcore South Rim Patrol.
Okay.
People like Cale Schaefer, people like Brian Wisher,
Right.
people like you could probably name five or six of them that have that quality. But what do they not want to be? They don't want to be cops.
That's right.
And when you had to bring, oh, who was the man who had cancer, colon cancer, and still worked? He worked in the corridor. Damn.
No, I'm drawing a blank.
I am too. But anyway, they decided they were going to rotate everybody in on South Rim Patrol at one point in my time, 18 years there, and that they were going to get, and they hated it. The backcountry rangers often hated coming in and working South Rim Patrol because they didn't want to do that. It takes a special person. One of the reasons I liked South Rim Patrol was not for the protection, but the EMS SAR and fire. And that was the price I had to pay to do the rest of it. But my personality was, if I have to do it, I'm going to be damn good at it, and I'm going to make sure everybody comes home alive after it. Because having lived there, I don't, well, hope you know this, that we got threatened by people in our own community,
Oh, yeah.
that we were ostracized. You go to a picnic with everybody else. Oh, you're the one who arrested my husband last week on a drunk driving charge. It was a difficult situation to be a part of the community if you're a protection ranger
Yep.
because the community is there. I remember when I was first going to short haul training, and Mike Myers, who was my supervisor, said, "You're going to go to training today?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, we arrested the pilot of the aircraft for drunk driving 2 days ago. Maybe he'll just drop you to the ground because he doesn't like you." He was kidding around like that, but that was the true case.
Right.
And it made me think twice, do I want to be under the helicopter with a guy they arrested? And it was a whole change of your attitude. So you can see why people get hard-boiled when people look at you from every angle, and the only ones you can trust are the other people with the guns.
Right.
And yeah, it does become a good old boy club because nobody else wants you in their club. But I made a point to have sing-alongs with Marker Marshall and Lori Rome and all the others, and to do other things. That was my choice to be that, and because I've had, I don't know, 75 kids at my houses on Halloween because I decorated, and that
And
is
had good
easy.
treats, and the word was
I
out.
did. I
Yeah.
did real candy bars, not
Yep.
these little things.
Yeah. Yeah.
I it's just really hard to judge. I think it's really hard to judge people not by yourself.
I think this topic is going to come up again as we move forward because I'm thinking of a couple of things too. But I'd like to wrap this interview up by going back
Okay.
to your first summer as a seasonal interpretive ranger at Sequoia National Park.
Yeah.
What happened that
And
summer?
I loved it. I gave walks, talks, evening program. Wasn't an EMT at the time.
Okay.
Every weekend I went backpacking somewhere
Oh, wow.
overnight. They also gave you something called backcountry days because they wanted, because at the time we wrote backcountry permits as well. We worked the front desk,
Okay.
answered questions, went out and give geology talks and giant sequoia talks and stuff. And so they gave you what they're called backcountry days. And so we were assigned 3 days. We could go wherever we wanted to, put our other 2 days on it, and then we would go one time. Are you ready for this? This is how young and healthy I was. I was with another ranger who went after work at 5 o'clock, left out of Mineral King, went across the Sierra Nevadas, crossed to Mount Whitney in 4 days, and came back around.
Well,
I know, 70 miles.
wonderful.
But whatever, I went to places nobody ever dreamed of. I've hiked on every trail in that park. I loved it. And the next summer, 1980, I was walking to work from my little cabin, going across the Marble Fork Bridge, and I remember this moment forever. And I smiled, and I looked at the river going on me, and I said, this is the happiest moment of my life. I'm doing exactly what I want to do in exactly the place I want to do it. I'm a naturalist. This is before they called them interpreters. I'm a naturalist at Sequoia National Park, and I get to tell people about all the wonderful things here, and I'm getting paid to do this, and I love my life, and I love my job.
Cool. Yeah.
That was the moment of my life. I still, there was no moment ever better than that moment.
Did your folks click into that? Did they get that?
Oh, my mom did for sure. My dad took him a little while to come around.
Okay,
you know?
But he did.
But when they came, they all came to visit. And one time my dad came to visit. This was probably 85 or something. And all my family had come up at different times, different places. My dad rode a motorcycle, much to my mother's chagrin. And he came and visited with my brothers. And I slept outside on a porch that faced to the east in the watchtower. And the cabin mate, she slept inside. She was Marianne Carlton. My that's how we became friends. We shared the same cabin together.
Cool.
But I slept outside. And so we had a bear in a bear trap, and they hauled it to the maintenance area and so people could come look at the bear. So I took my two brothers down to show them the bear. My dad said, nah, he's going to sit on my bed on the porch and just look out at nature. And so we came back and said, let's tell you about the bear. He goes, don't tell me about a bear. Won't walk right by your cabin door. But no, he got it.
Cool.
He got it. And I had at one point to borrow money from him. And that was the day he said, you know what, you are. He did. He says, I really think you're happy doing what you're doing. And the $1,000 you owe me, don't worry about it.
Wow.
And so he forgave my loan. But that was pretty, for somebody who was pretty poor, because I had to buy health insurance, and so he helped me buy that. It wasn't for school or anything else, but I had to buy health insurance. So
wow.
I was happy to do that.
So he got it. He came around. Very cool.
Kinda.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
In maybe in the best way he could.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So they loved Sequoia National Park. We went there all the time as kids. Sometime I'll tell you about a great story about when we camped there as kids. But they loved that they could come and visit. And my mom would say that he was very proud to say that his daughter was a park ranger.
Cool.
And so was she. Even though every now and then she would say I was a forest ranger, which drove me crazy. But I used to be.
Yeah.
When I went to the parks, you know, there's a different department.
Yeah.
The Interior, Department of Agriculture, da-da-da-da.
That's right. That's right.
Wow, the hour went fast, didn't it?
It did, didn't it? Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this series, and
okay.
We will pick it up next time in the summer of 1981. You've graduated now with your master's degree. Does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, it sounds good. We probably should backtrack just a little bit so I can fill in a blank for you, but yeah.
Yeah.
80, 81.
Okay, very good. Cool.
Thanks, Tom, and I won't hang up this time.
All right, very good. And so with that, this will conclude part two, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Nancy Eileen Melody Meekum. Today is Tuesday, December 1, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. Nancy, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.